This is KHSU.
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 KHSU. One more time, that's 826-4805, 1-800-640-5911, and 492-KHSU. Now over to Eric Kirk.
Good evening. As advertised, my name is Eric Kirk. My guest tonight is Joshua Mizell, professor of sociology and also criminology.
Criminology and justice studies is our new major.
Right. And you also head up the cannabis. What's the project?
I'm one of the co-directors of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research.
All right. Now, I know everybody is probably burned out on the election, but we've got 17 ballot propositions and a lot of people are having a hard time with this telephone book thick thing. If anybody wants, I have actually written up my thoughts on it. I'm not because this is a nonprofit radio station, I'm really not at liberty to share how I will vote, but I don't necessarily want you to follow my recommendations. I do put a lot of thought into trying to explain each of the propositions, and so I've got something that's considerably shorter than the book. And so if you want to contact me at ericvkirk@gmail.com, make sure you get the V in there, because Eric Kirk actually goes to some conservative guy back on the East Coast who's tired of getting my political stuff. But anyways, Joshua's here to talk his specialty being criminology. We're going to focus tonight on the four propositions that pertain to criminal law, although when we start to take calls, if anybody has any questions or wants to bring up any other aspect of this really big ballot that we're all going to be voting on Tuesday, those of us who don't vote early, or if you want to comment on anything that's said, you can join us at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. But tonight we're going to discuss Props 57, Prop 62 and 66, and also Proposition 64. We're going to start with that. And Josh, why don't you want to? Did I miss anything about your background you want to emphasize?
I think one of the things that I could share that is germane to some of these propositions is I have a background working in the juvenile justice system in Colorado, about 6.5 years.
Well, that's going to be relevant to Proposition 57, isn't it?
Yeah,
maybe that's a good segue, because Proposition 57 actually has two parts to it. You want to explain what it does?
Proposition 57 is concerned both with the adult system and the juvenile system. The adult system, if passed, the proposition would basically allow a greater proportion of nonviolent adult offenders to be eligible for parole. A substantial number have indeterminate sentencing, which means that the point at which they could be eligible for parole is really left up to the Board of Parole, in the state of California.
Right.
And so this would make eligible a larger number. Actually, I may have that wrong. As you pointed out, Eric, we're dealing with a overwhelming number of propositions. And
sure.
I was actually just looking at this earlier. I want to make sure I have that right. Maybe a greater proportion are serving determinant sentences. Yeah, most people in state prison have received a determinant sentence. And so I think the issue is more with those who have been sentenced under determinant sentencing. One piece of Proposition 57 would make them eligible for parole, and with
if they did some type of rehabilitation program or some type of education.
To the extent that that's provided in the California prison system,
they can earn credits or something.
Right, and there will be some shifts in the allocation, an increase in how much credit for good time served. That will change. And, it's important to keep in mind that Prop 57 is actually, I think, one of Governor Brown's signature pieces of legislation he's trying to get passed before he leaves office to really address the the overcrowding crisis that has faced California prisons since the, probably extending beyond the 1980s.
And we have actually, there's a Supreme Court decision saying we're supposed to start, supposed to reduce the population, and we haven't gotten there yet, have we? We're not in compliance yet.
We're not in compliance, and, you know, the first phase, is, if you will, of trying to get the state in compliance was realignment, where basically nonviolent offenders were shifted back to the counties where they are housed in jails and completed their sentences at the county level. And that's, you know, that's created a host of issues and concerns.
Now, when we say it makes people eligible if they do certain things for parole, does it take any of the discretion away from the parole boards, or does it mandate that they're released on for certain things?
That is a very good question.
Yeah, I can't tell from reading it, and I'm a lawyer, so I'm wondering, you know, whether it will do that. My reading of it is it simply provides an opportunity to have credits if you do certain things, if you have got good behavior, if you educate yourself through to prepare yourself for releasing, that it's something that the parole board can consider, whereas right now it's more restrictive. I'm not really clear on that. I mean, there was a time when everybody was eligible for parole. Charles Manson, because he predated the problem, he is eligible for parole. Now, we all know that no parole board is going to let him out, but ever. But he, technically speaking, every certain amount of years it comes up, and they have to consider his arguments.
Yeah, but we've... There are a substantial number of folks in California prisons serving life sentences with the possibility of parole, and we'll actually be talking about that when we get to Prop 62 regarding the death penalty, who were legally eligible for parole, but for a long time there, governors would basically veto the decisions of parole boards, and they were not making parole. Even though they were eligible and they had done everything they needed to do. This piece of this ballot measure is intended to address the backlog. For a number of different reasons, whether, you know, one's concerned with, the expense to the state of California, whether they're concerned with this as a social justice issue, whether they're concerned with this in terms of, making communities safer. The vast majority of people do get out. And so the question is, are we going to keep them longer and just release them, or are we going to release them and provide something when they get out?
And provide some kind of incentive for them to rehabilitate while they're in there.
While they're...
That
gets tricky because, again, there's the assumption that, you could change the name of a state agency, but whether they actually provide rehabilitation, there's different perspectives on whether the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation actually does provide rehabilitation. Lessons from history tell us that to a large extent, these systems are largely about holding people, keeping people.
Right.
Some would argue caging people. So it's different perspectives.
I wonder if the measure does pass, if it will put an impetus to, since it's in the language of what would be the new statute, if it would put an impetus and sort of mandate that they start providing these things universally. I mean, it doesn't really do any good if the programs aren't available.
Right. And some of the changes have come from the federal court orders. I'm blanking on the what happened with the California Department of Corrections, but they're under order for providing or being in violation of federal law in terms of providing adequate medical care and mental health services. And so certainly, if we think about making sure those essential services are being provided, the courts have done a lot to try to deal with that. But in terms of this proposition, the proposition doesn't mandate that services be provided.
No, it just says if you take advantage of them, if they're available.
If they're available. And, you know, I've done a considerable amount of work looking at parole, largely on the youth side, but even on the adult side, I mean, where it's actually more deficient compared to the youth side of things. On the adult side, parole is largely a mechanism for early release. That's its origins, and parole officers largely in a position to you know, they're in positions to monitor the whereabouts of parolees. Sometimes they may try to broker, and it's not to say parole agents are not don't care about their the parolees who are working with them, but you know, they're often overwhelmed, and so what they can actually provide in terms of helping get folks linked up to services, to housing, to education, to employment, you know, all of the different things that somebody needs to make it, it's a tall order.
It is. Why don't we take a look at the second part of it pertaining to juvenile law?
Great. Let's do that. The second part of Proposition 57 concerns the process by which youth end up or get referred into the adult system. It's important to keep in mind that we are talking about a relatively very small number of people, but we, you know, as we'll be discussing when we talk about the death penalty, we're talking about an exceptionally small proportion of the adult population when we talk about people on death row. So when we're looking at the youth population who comes into contact with the juvenile justice system in the state of California, the proportion that potentially or actually do get referred into the adult system is a minuscule proportion.
And it's for serious.
Generally for serious offenses, but it's age graded in terms of, you know, if the youth is, I believe it's 16 to 17, there could be automatic transfer to the adult system. If they're younger, then it's either currently the way it works is it's up to the prosecutor,
right, discretion. And this would take it the discretion away from the prosecutor, allow for a court determination as to whether or not the child should stand trial as an adult.
Exactly. And so really what we're talking about is different court actors making this decision, shifting that decision-making process away from the prosecutor to the judge. And, you know, historically, prosecutors, I mean, we think about essentially an adversarial system, you know, although the juvenile system is not supposed to be adversarial,
right?
But the court system being adversarial, the prosecutor represents the people, the state. The interests of the youth are not necessarily their primary concern. Mm-hmm. And so that being said, what we see is, you know, especially when if we're concerned about, you know, issues of social justice and the juvenile justice system and who's getting referred into the adult system, what we see is a pattern of, you know, largely marginalized groups, poor people or specifically youth of color who are more likely to get referred into the adult system because of the that I would arguably is kind of the political basis of a decision that's made by a prosecutor because sure. They are an elected official.
Although judges are elected too, they have to do it. But it tends to not be as a political race, and right. So the argument is that it would remove some of the politics from it and make it maybe less of an emotional decision. At least that's the theory.
Yeah, and let me just clarify. I mean, when I'm appealing to kind of history and precedent on this, the pattern is that prosecutors or district attorneys, they enter office with a very tough on crime position, and so they're least likely, when you think about this adversarial relationship, to be as balanced perhaps as a judge should be in that position, but they are. You're right. They are both certainly elected officials.
Right. Yeah. It's rare. I mean, you do have challengers for the judge. It's kind of rare, and it's not like you're going to talk about your policies when you run for DA. You're going to say, "Well, I'm going to do this, this, and this." Mm-hmm. Judge. It's almost kind of hard because they don't say, "Well, what they're going to do." They just take the cases as they come. So I think the theory is that it takes a bit of the politics out of it, and also. Also, you know, as you said, the district attorney is the one that is pushing it from an adversarial position. I guess the argument on the other side would be that, well, that's the district attorney's job. If the district attorney messes that up, a jury will probably not want to convict the person if there is any type of sympathy as a child. So I guess people would argue that should be the check and balance, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to turning it over to the court to make a determination. And I'm not sure if it addresses what the criteria is. I mean, you know, there's some guidelines as to you know, what would a judge base the decision on? Is there?
Well, yeah, I mean, typically what that process that we're talking about is called a it's a fitness hearing. And so the judge is making a decision. Again, it's age graded, but has to do with the offense. It has to do not just with the actual crime that allegedly occurred, but also the circumstances around the event. Sometimes if there are aggravating circumstances, but it is age graded. And so, you know, it's important to keep in mind that when we talk about referrals of youth into the adult system in the state of California, youth 14 and older are eligible. Mm-hmm. And this, and what's interesting, this varies enormously by state. Some states it's as young as 12 who could be referred into the adult system. And this is more of a recent phenomenon too.
Now, you know, one of the criticisms of this proposition is that it's really two propositions in one.
Yeah,
and it puts some voters in a difficult position if they would support one but not the other, and they've got to make a choice as to which one is more important. Do you have any ideas to why they merged these two instead of having them be separate propositions? I mean,
I don't know about the origins and the interest groups that are behind Prop 57, but I think in terms of what they represent, mm-hmm. I think the assumption is that folks who are going to support keeping youth in the juvenile system, which is really what it would do, or at least it would provide the belief is that it, you know, perhaps provides more due process so that they can potentially be retained in the juvenile justice system, that is believed to be more likely to provide more rehabilitation than that will be there. And then on the adult side, consistent with that kind of belief in rehabilitation and being more concerned about really ensuring that folks who are going to get out are going to be successful and contributing members of society. On the adult side, recognizing, you know, that 95% of the people that go into prison eventually do get out. So let's actually think about, well, do we really need to be holding nonviolent offenders in prison as long as we are? So,
all right, you're listening to KHSU. This is Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk, and my guest is Professor Josh Mizell. We are discussing the propositions which pertain to criminal law, since that is Professor Mizell's specialty. Before we move off of Prop 57, I know that one of the controversies has been as to what constitutes a nonviolent crime that would make it eligible for this particular program. I guess the argument is that arson could be considered a nonviolent crime, hostage taking, a couple other things, and it's a dispute as to whether or not those would be on the list. Do you have any?
Well, I mean, yeah, and I'm looking through the phone book right here. I mean, the voter guide, mm-hmm. and there's it makes reference to. I mean, it's the reference is going to be to the penal code and the. Whether we're talking about offenses that are considered to be violent in nature. You know, I mean, this always gets really sticky because we're talking about definitions and categories. You know, somebody could say that, you know, drug use could be a violent offense. If the result of drug use is that somebody fails to take care of their child or they get in a car accident and somebody gets hurt. Well, but then that's called reckless driving or, you know, I think you get my point here, but it gets a little slippery when you're trying to pull those out. Certainly, the opponents of Prop 57 are arguing that you know, if passed, this will allow. I mean, it's actually interesting to see some of the language that's used. You know, thugs. What do they have here? Thugs. I'm leafing through the phone book here for the listening
you're
audience.
You're looking for the proponents and opposition.
Yeah. It was just some of the language is quite colorful.
You've got it. That's there. Yeah. While you're looking for that, let me give out the phone numbers for people who want to join the conversation. Phone number is 826-4805 if you're local, or 1-800-640-5911 if you're out of the area. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. And you find it?
It was language I saw, excuse me, under Prop 62. I apologize.
We'll get to
Prop 62.
All right. Well, Prop 57, is arson violent? But we're talking about eligibility, too. We're not talking about a guarantee of anybody being released as well. So obviously, the parole board would take into account the nature of the crime in terms of whether or not there's going to be recidivism or if there is, in fact, there's been rehabilitation. Now, how does a parole board determine that? Obviously, there's no guarantees one way or another.
Sometimes these decisions are made by political and historic context. If there's a lot of pressure on a parole board to be releasing folks, we're dealing with overcrowding in the state of California. They're more likely to do that, especially if they know they have a governor that's going to approve of that parole being granted. But though, what I wanted to say, though, in regards to this proposition, I think is it generally what it comes down to is a decision about how, in terms of the sides lining up pro and against. I think those who are opposed to the proposition frame the concerns in terms of public safety, in terms of dangerous offenders getting out. In terms of dangerous youth that are going to be, the terminology that folks often use is coddled in the juvenile justice system, as opposed to being referred into the adult system. Those who support Prop 57, they're critiquing kind of that path that we have tried and used and implemented nationally for the past 20 plus some odd or more than 20 years, and it has not been sustainable.
It's it tied in with a lot of people who advocate what's called restorative justice and other approaches.
Sure. Yeah, thinking about different ways in which we can conceptualize what justice looks like. Yeah, moving away from a retribution-based system to thinking about trying to heal communities. Just to be clear, though, these propositions have nothing to do with healing communities.
Sure.
It's just about, providing a release mechanism to reduce overcrowding, to save the state funds, to get it out of the sights of federal court orders.
And the neutral analysis does say there would be savings.
Sure, absolutely.
To the state. So.
Absolutely.
All right, why don't we move on to Proposition 62? Do you want to? Well, we start with 62, and then it kind of goes with 66. They're kind of on the opposite sides of each other, but let's start with what Prop 62 does.
Yeah, well, Prop 62, quite simply, would repeal the death penalty and replace it with life without the possibility of parole. It just placing these things in context. The United States stands rather alone amongst Western democracies in its continued use of the death penalty. We're rather exceptional in that way. We have not executed somebody in the state of California, I believe, since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are opposed to repealing the death penalty are concerned that it will result in an increase in crime, that we're not acknowledging the rights of victims in terms of seeing justice carried out.
Right.
Although I believe that I wouldn't say I'm 100% certain, but I'm quite certain that just about everybody on death row is there resulting from a homicide. So it gets a little difficult when we think about victims. Presumably, we're talking about families,
sure.
You know, families and communities that have lost loved ones, and their needs have to be addressed.
And certainly, when to get on death row, it's not something like, well, you hit somebody too hard in a bar fight and they die of a hemorrhage.
Yeah.
It's something usually much more serious. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is more serious.
It requires special circumstances such as torture, such as lying in wait, such as more than one person or an officer being killed. There's special circumstances that bring you to that. So it's not your run-of-the-mill murder. These are as we saw the movie, what was The Last Man Walking? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very interesting because it was an anti-death penalty film, but Sean Penn played a character who was totally not sympathetic.
Oh, Dead Man Walking.
Dead Man Walking. Because most of the people on there have done some really horrific things. So, you know, it's...
This is a very tough issue because fundamentally we're coming down to questions of justice. Mm-hmm. You know, what does justice look like? And so we were talking a moment ago about retributive versus restorative justice, and certainly the death penalty is assumed to represent the most extreme form of justice. I mean, certainly it's non-reversible,
right?
And those who believe in the death penalty believe in this, certainly this ultimate form of retribution.
Right, but it separates into two issues, too, because one of the things I mentioned that I did another show on another radio station with an advocate and an opponent of the death penalty talking about both of these propositions. And I asked each of them. I asked the woman who opposed the death penalty if it was proven that the death penalty was a deterrent to murder, would you support it? She said no. Mm-hmm. And I asked the gentleman who supports the death penalty, if it was proven that the death penalty was in no way a deterrent, would you still support it? And he said yes, because we just have to have that be the rule. That is the justice. If you take a life, you know, in such a way, then you forfeit your right to live. That's what he kept saying over and over. You have forfeited your right to live. And then we got back into the discussion, well, what if you make a mistake, blah, blah, blah. But it's very interesting because both sides bring up the deterrence issue, but the advocates and the opponents don't necessarily govern themselves based on that. I don't know how many people are out there who say I support the death penalty or I oppose the death penalty because it's a deterrent, but rather because this is what justice should say.
Yeah, and so when I talk about the death penalty with my students, I do frame this in terms of the question of what are we trying to accomplish? I mean, if it's about retribution, you know, that's largely a kind of a moral, ethical, philosophical, if you will, decision that's being made. But if the goal, as you frame it in terms of deterrent, you know, if it's to act as a deterrent, you know, the evidence that I find most compelling suggests that it's not doing what it's meant to do, but more importantly, it may have actually the opposite effect. Research calls that the brutalization effect, that we know when following the use of the death penalty, we see a spike in crime.
Well, and that came up in that debate, and as the woman said, look, the places that have the death penalty in the United States tend to be the states with the highest rates of murder, and the guy's response was, well, by that virtue, if you're going to associate that, then you might as well argue that insulin is what's causing diabetes, because people who have diabetes take insulin. It's because those states have those murders that we have the death penalty, and the states that don't have as high murders or the countries in Europe don't need it because they don't have the same problems.
Right. Yeah, another related piece has to do with what we know about homicide in this country. I mean, there's lots that could be said, certainly, about the context in which death penalty cases get handled. In a nutshell, what I think is important to recognize is that, you know, certainly when we're talking about justice, what we're trying to achieve as a system, it's also important to recognize how justice has failed in so many different ways across the country. And when I'm talking about justice in terms of the criminal justice system, the ways in which it's failed different communities in different cases. You know, certainly the advent of the use of DNA in criminal cases has revealed that. For readers out there, you know, John Grisham wrote, you know, very readable book on two folks who were one was sentenced to death 4 days from execution, in The Innocent Man. That's the title of the book, and very compelling story about the ways in which one can be wrongfully convicted, the way in which somebody can be so close to be executed. And so, you know, those who are supporting Proposition 62 raise this question about, you know, the possibility of executing an innocent person. And, you know, do we want to continue operating system where there is that doubt? So what we also know is that Americans love the death penalty. And the, you know, so for those who crafted the proposition, they recognize that the only way to make this palpable to voters is to offer an alternative of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole.
Plus the work having to do.
The work, yeah. Which is a very interesting element, especially those who have been watching who have watched the Netflix film 13th. Which looks at the significance of the 13th Amendment.
Right. This is slavery. Basically, if you're on death row or you murder, you are expected to work, earn money, and give a certain portion of your money to the family of the victim.
Right. And if you talk to inmates, inmates on death row, they raise the question about money they have in their accounts that family members have provided. So it may not just be money that they've earned, but support that family members have provided that could be docked for victim restitution. So life without the possibility of parole is presented as the alternative. And, you know, we know, again, from polling data that when voters are presented with that as the alternative, support for the death penalty drops substantially. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, yeah. California kind of being the state where these sorts of decisions are going to be made, or potentially, death penalty focus and other groups were successful in getting this on the ballot.
All right. You're listening to KHSU. This is Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk. My guest is Professor Josh Mizell. And we are currently at this moment. And let me give you out the phone number again, 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. One of the arguments, too, is that if we ban the death penalty on Tuesday, this is what, again, the proponent of the death penalty said, on Wednesday there'll be a move to end life sentences, to end sentences mm-hmm. without parole. And there probably will be, because in Europe, some of the countries, their maximum sentences are 35 years, mm-hmm. I think, in France, 40. I think Britain still has a death penalty on the books for treason, but hasn't been used since like World War One or something. So it's there probably will be a push, but they feel like if they lose that, that life without parole isn't going to mean anything because they're gonna fight life without mm-hmm. parole next, and probably true.
So if you're opposed to the death penalty, the argument is that this is a kind of an incremental change, and then the next battle, if you will, is what some call the slower form of death, being life without the possibility of parole. Mm-hmm. That would be the next battle. You know, again, we can look back to the juvenile system for some insight on this. The death penalty existed for juveniles up until when was it, 2010?
Right,
and then the high court struck that down in terms of the Eighth Amendment regarding cruel and unusual punishment, and also evolving standards of decency was the language that Justice Kennedy referred to in seeing that it was really not being used as it had been. More recently, the High Court has ruled down the use, or ruled against the use, continued use of life without the possibility of parole for juveniles. And so if there is any sort of osmosis, if you will, from the juvenile system into the adult system, that may be the case that it's decided at the from the High Court.
All right. Listen, we're going to take a call. Sandra and Eureka, you're on the air.
Hey, I do not support the death penalty. You know, it's like, what do people not get about thou shalt not kill? But I think the prison system is not designed to rehabilitate. But if it's, I think they, we just need to worry about protecting society. So you lock the bad guys up. You don't kill them. You just lock them up.
So in other words, the role of the government is to protect society, not exact vengeance per se, but to do what it needs to do to protect society from people who cannot control themselves.
Exactly.
Sandra, that's a great observation. A lot of people have that concern. One of the things that I've learned from my work as a criminologist in looking at a lot of different types of research is we find that as we get older, and I know I'm certainly finding it in my own life, but as we get older, that the likelihood of people actually engaging in the kinds of crimes that we're concerned about drops precipitously. In fact, the peak age for people to commit crimes is in their early 20s, maybe as early as 20. And we also know that people who are on death row and people who are serving long sentences, and if they're serving 10, 20 years, depending upon when they've entered, that could be a lifetime sentence.
Yeah.
In fact, the person on death row who's been there the longest has been there for 37 years, which is kind of a mind-boggling thought. So the question we have to ask is, and that's a totally legitimate question, an important question to ask, what are the risks to public safety? You know, and so who are we talking about? And you know, if the determination of public safety is simply somebody getting out, and then they're automatically there's going to be this urge or desire to commit a new crime, as opposed to, well, what are the circumstances of their incarceration? What's their experience of incarceration? And then what will be available when they get out? So if you have somebody who's been in prison for 37 years, what does it look like for that person to step out of prison?
I can't imagine.
They dealt with that in the Shawshank Redemption.
But I just think, we don't need to be vengeful. You know, the purpose of prison is not necessarily to rehabilitate, although I agree that a lot of people do get rehabilitated or they grow to an age where they're not likely to commit crime. And I'm all for, you know, having them evaluated and letting them out on parole. It's just that my attitude about prisons is we don't have to be vengeful. You know, we just need to protect society. So you put people, you know, wherever. I mean, I don't care if they're in luxury rooms, just so they're not let out, as long as they're a danger to society.
What I'd propose is that if the measure of how long somebody should be held is truly about at what point are they no longer a danger to society, I would argue that people would be in prison for much shorter lengths, and probably are. We'd probably be thinking then too very differently about what happens in prison, because as I said earlier,
it might be a point of diminishing returns where you actually start to become more dangerous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and that's the big danger. That's the big danger.
Walk that fine line. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandra. All right. Well, why don't we? We've pretty much, I think, summarized Prop 62. Why don't we move over to Prop 66?
I want to just add one other element to the conversation about Proposition 62. Those who are opposed to it, I mean, there are different groups that are opposed to it, obviously, those who support the death penalty, but there are others who are opposed to Proposition 62 from the standpoint of what replacing the death penalty with life without the possibility of parole represents. And there's a real concern that if the new extreme shifts from being the death penalty, LWOP, as it's termed, that becomes the new normal, that we are normalizing what, you know, as I've said, people refer to as a slower form of death. And is that a, is that an acceptable possibility?
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's a question of, you know, how does social change happen? And perhaps the political moment right now is what this will allow, and we can't do anything more. And
right.
That's what people say.
It seems like each time there is an anti-death penalty, there's something to sweeten the package that has the average anti-death penalty person saying, why are you throwing that in there? Mm-hmm. What was that doing there? Well, it's to make it palatable, and that's what politics is about, of course, is trying to make it palatable to the largest number of people who might vote for it under those circumstances.
And what's very interesting, actually, is missing from a lot of the conversations about the death penalty is the perspective of those folks on death row. Mm-hmm. And if you visit, I think it's an anti-death penalty website. I think it's Californians Against the Death Penalty. Mm-hmm. It's if you do a search on Voices from Death Row, you've got written responses to a questionnaire that was sent to men and women on death row in California asking for their perspectives on the two death penalty initiatives that we're talking about.
Right.
And it's very interesting. It's only about, you know, 45 people that provided responses out of about 750 people on death row in California. But what you find is that actually they don't support it.
Right. Yeah.
They don't support it.
Interesting. That group, I think I called them a few years back for somebody to speak about some issue that was in the news. I don't remember, but it was death penalty related. And I think they gave me Mike Farrell, actor.
Okay,
He was heading it up at the time, and it was, here I am interviewing Mike Farrell, probably the most famous person.
Yep.
Anyways, why don't we talk a little bit about Proposition 66? And we should know that the way Proposition 66 is written is that if both 62 and 66 pass, 66 would actually override Proposition 62. At least that's the way it's written. Whether or not that would actually happen.
My understanding is the initiative that the ballot measure that receives the most votes.
Will prevail. Will nullify the other.
Right.
However, Proposition 62 people put in a severability clause, which is to say, because you really, there's only supposed to be nullification when they deal with the same issue. And since they both offer having that, what some people are referring to as the 13th Amendment violation, they both offer different variations of working for the families of the victims, or the victims in the case of some crimes. That might override it, but Proposition 62 defensively put in a severability clause saying that they can't override our ban of the death penalty. So we'll see what happens in the courts should Prop 66 pass with more votes than Prop 62. But if you really want the death penalty to be banned, the message in there is that you should vote yes on 62 and no on 66. If you don't, then you should vote yes on 66 and no on 62, because you don't want to leave it to the courts to decide that very complex issue.
Yeah.
But Proposition 66 does seek to override Prop 62 in that sense, that if it gets more votes. But what else does it do?
It also, what critics of Prop 66 argue is it accelerates the appeals process while removing protections and resources for those who have been condemned.
Cuts down on the appellate process.
Exactly.
It says that it should be done within 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it also takes the habeas proceedings out of the hands of the Supreme Court and brings it down to the trial court level.
To the trial court, to the county.
Yeah. Which a lot of questions about that, because as we mentioned earlier, those judges are elected, whereas the Supreme Court justices are in for life if they stay there. And habeas corpus has traditionally gone to the highest court of the land. That's where you go to say, hey, I'm in prison. I need to be free. That's separate from appeals. That's where you say, I'm not supposed to be imprisoned, and I need to be set free. It's a direct action of itself, not an appeal of an early decision. It could be based on a lack of due process or something like that, but the Supreme Court has a lot of those, and they're overwhelmed, and this would turn it back. Proposition 66 would bring it back to the county.
And proponents of Proposition 66 argue that, you know, we need to shorten the process. We are allowing too many condemned folks to file, you know, what they suggest are petty claims, you know, and that the perception is that the men and women on death row, they're guilty, they're fighting tooth and nail their convictions,
and you've got somebody who's been there for 37 years and may die of natural causes before he's executed.
Before they, so. And you know, which is an interesting situation when you think about it, that the state's job is to keep this person as alive and healthy so that the state can determine when they're going to die.
Yeah.
You know, and
in fact, there's very strict anti-suicide procedures when you are
absolutely
going to be exercised.
Absolutely, which contributes to the cost of death row. Mm-hmm. You know, it does cost more to keep somebody on death row than to actually incarcerate them. No, actually, excuse me, I have that backwards. It costs more to have somebody. Yeah, it costs more to have somebody on death row. I didn't have that backwards.
Right.
It costs more to have somebody on death row than to incarcerate them in prison for the rest of their life.
But their argument is that, well, hey, we remove some of the appeals.
Exactly.
That's less money going to lawyers, and it won't be so expensive.
Exactly.
Problem
and that's what they are arguing. And you see that in here. There will be a reduction in costs in terms of the appeals process and providing representation. And it's actually for that reason that you know, men and women on death row, you know, I made a reference to the voices from death row, what they write, you know, that they're opposed to 66 for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. but they're also opposed to 64 because they don't want to lose access to the appellate protections and the legal resources that are provided when you're on death row. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there are other concerns that they have. But so in a nutshell, Prop 66 is largely about accelerating the process, reducing the costs of having somebody on death row.
Mm-hmm.
And as proponents of Prop 66 argue, you know, their slogan is mend, not end, the death penalty. Those who are opposed to the death penalty are voting against Prop 66. Those who support it are obviously going to support Prop 66.
Because the argument against it is that, you know, you remove the appeals process, you're making it so that there are fewer opportunities to correct a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. And you noted before that both of them right now are below 50%.
Yeah, they're both losing. They're both losing in the poll. The most recent polls show that actually of the initiatives we're discussing, well, I don't want to give away the punchline because we haven't talked about the other ones yet, but Prop 57 appears to be not winning, I shouldn't say wait, there's no election yet, but in terms of the most recent polling data shows 61% in favor.
Ooh,
versus 16% opposed. Prop 62, only 35% in favor compared to 53% opposed. So there's still undecided voters out there, of course.
Yeah, but those are pretty big margins.
They are big margins.
Yeah.
And but also Prop 66 is losing. And that's been a recent shift. It did seem to have a greater proportion of likely voters supporting it right now. 35% of Californians appear to be, those who are likely to vote, in support of Prop 66 compared to 43% who are opposed.
And if the vote goes that way, the message being, no, we're not ready to get rid of the death penalty, but no, we're not ready to speed up the process and take more chances either. So it's interesting, interesting vote. Listen, this is you're listening to KHSU. This is Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk. My guest is Professor Joshua Mizell. We are discussing, we have discussed Propositions 57 and 62 and 66. And unless we have more to say on those two, we're going to move on to Prop 64 in a moment. But if you want to get in to the discussion here in the last 12 minutes, phone number is 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. We have a text. You can also text to us if you want to send us. It's a new feature, 492-KHSU. We will read your statement over the air if you're shy or don't want to talk. That's, what was that number again? 492-KHSU. I forgot all about that.
Well, gosh, Eric, I was hoping that a phone line was going to light up with a Christmas tree, but that's just not going to happen
tonight. Oh, it's you know what? A lot of people have voted already. I think people are kind of burned out, but this is also, but a lot of people will also be listening. And probably if we'd started with the next one, we'd be getting calls because it's probably the most controversial in this area. And we're only going to be able to have about 10 minutes to discuss it. And it's been a topic of huge amounts. What does Prop 64 do?
Well, yeah, so you think Humboldt County residents have any feelings about Prop 64?
Yeah.
Prop 64, of course, deals with the legalization of cannabis. I tend to use the word cannabis these days rather than the, as its name, marijuana. In fact, the state of California has changed their how they refer to the Bureau of Medical Cannabis Control Board. They removed marijuana from the language. But basically, this would legalize recreational cannabis in the state of California. It does not... The regulations are not in this initiative, mm-hmm. but there's a regulatory intent that right. voters are being asked whether they approve or object to. And it does a number of things. And, you know...
It's also unusual in that it empowers the legislature to fill in the gaps, correct?
Exactly.
That's different, and a lot of people don't trust that. Other people are saying, you know, we're trying to do something complicated. We need to have flexibility, so let's...
Well, it allows the legislature to fill in the gaps as long as the work of the legislature adheres to the spirit or the intent of of the proposition. And so as long as, for those who support Proposition 64 and the legalization of cannabis, as long as they agree with the intent of what this is trying to accomplish, then the work is in the details in terms of making right. this a reality.
Now, what is there? Some people are saying in 5 years the corporations will take over. What's that all about?
Well, there is a kind of a time graded rollout, if you will, of ever larger. Operations in terms of cannabis enterprise, and it allows what is referred to in the industry as vertical integration. So I can grow and I can manufacture and I can distribute. These are all terms that the state uses. Mm-hmm. I could transport. I could essentially have my hands in all different aspects of it, and there is concern about the scale, what this represents in terms of the scale of the industry. Mm-hmm. So people have been talking about that.
Right. Now, Proposition 19 was a legalization attempt that was a few years back. It went down to defeat, and it went down to defeat in, at least Southern Humboldt. I don't know about Humboldt County.
I think Humboldt County voted it down.
It was 2-1 down in mm-hmm. Southern Humboldt. Now, I don't know if there's a legalization that they would support. I don't,
That's
you know.
That's an excellent question, Eric.
But the question is, these issues, a lot of it has to do with, the climate and the criminality. I will definitely repeat. I'll do that at the end of the show. I've got a couple things to plug at the end of the show, and we're getting towards that. But anyways, I guess the question is, you know, for Humboldt County, we know that the economy here is based upon an industry that kind of thrives on its illegality for the price level. And there are concerns about what could happen to the local economy after Tuesday.
Absolutely. I mean, well, like with just about any proposition that you could read about in your election phone book, I think it's always important to ask who stands to benefit and who stands to lose. You know, so when we talk about Humboldt County and we're talking about creating regulations where there's no regulation, and the only regulation right now is no regulation.
Right.
And so if we are going to bring this industry out into the proverbial sunlight, that reduces or eliminates the risk premium that's been there, that's jacked up the prices.
Yes. And so, and in fact, every time we pass something like Prop 215, the prices have been dropping gradually because more people are willing to do it.
So the market gets saturated. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, understandably, people are concerned about this in terms of, you know, what that means to the local economy. At the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research, we've been raising these questions for a number of years now, in terms of trying to better understand what it means as we are kind of moving, as all signs seem to indicate, through a period of transition, maybe moving away from a model of prohibition. Mm-hmm. We've shifted towards more decriminalization or medicalization, right, as far as medical is concerned, to perhaps outright legalization. And the dilemma is that we are one of 50 states, although more than half of states have either legalized recreational and medical, or decriminalized. The big issue is that the feds have not acted. And so the concern, going back to the question you raised about large, you know, corporations moving in or tobacco companies, I mean, there's lots of, you know, kind of rumors and claims that are made about, you know, people buying up land in the hills and that sort of thing. I think the big issue is that as long as the federal government and specifically the DEA keeps cannabis scheduled as a Schedule I substance, and the feds don't set up any sort of process to allow its potential legalization, there will always be added value,
sure,
to move cannabis off out of recreational, out of medical. I mean, everybody knows that there's a substantial proportion of allegedly medical that is diverted to recreational.
Absolutely. I actually was talking with somebody at the planning department, because we're talking about, as we have these new regulations for growing and the rest, they were concerned that if Congress had taken it out of Schedule One, it would have upended all of Prop 215, because if it actually is treated as a medicine at the federal level, then there are federal mandates for having to have it be prescription, to have guidelines from the medical community as to what the appropriate prescriptions are. It would actually have to be a prescribed drug. You'd have to get it from your pharmacist.
Right.
And so, you know, wondering if even though there's lack of political will to maintain the prohibition status, I wonder if the resistance to taking it out of Schedule One is because they don't want to create a practical shock to the system.
Unless they somehow
exempt it.
That's a very good point. A very good point. You know, and what's interesting, if you look at the record on the DEA's decision around that, you know, they, on the one hand, they're arguing that we just don't have enough research evidence suggesting that there's medical benefit. You know, that's what the DEA says. But then they also do, and this is important for listeners, the DEA itself actually states very clearly that all of the claims and the research about cannabis as a gateway drug have been disproven.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite a... you know,
but that doesn't give it medicinal, you know, necessarily. A lot of it's anecdotal. I'm like saying, okay, when are we going to do the studies to determine one way or another? Then finance some studies. I do remember, it cracked me up, I don't remember which official was. I think it was somebody in the Bush administration who said, oh, no, there's no proof that that marijuana helps with appetite. It's like, you got the whole 7-Eleven Doritos industry wrapped around that. You know, I mean, you know, it does. Appetite, that's taken by somebody who obviously never took it, but you know, that's
So I would, what I would suggest, I mean, because I know we don't have a lot of time
yeah,
here.
We're out of time.
What I would just suggest to listeners, if you know, I think a good way to maybe make a little bit of sense around what legalization might look like is to look at other states. And I know that the Colorado Department of Public Safety put out the preliminary findings on the impacts of cannabis legalization in Colorado came out just a few months ago, and they look at traffic fatalities, youth substance use, arrests. I know that the district attorney from Denver actually just has sent letters to California newspapers urging voters in California to oppose it, you know, making various claims about what's happened in his state, and specifically in the city and county of Denver. Lots of different positions around that.
We're going to have to wrap this up. Do you have a real quick closing thought?
I'm a professor. I have no quick closing thoughts. That's kind of difficult.
I appreciate it. Let me just take care of a little bit of housekeeping here. Caller asked for me to repeat my info, for my recommendations. It is Eric V. Kirk, ericvkirk @gmail.com. If you somehow forget that, you can also call me up. I'm an attorney locally, and you can call me at the office and just give me your email address, and I'll be happy to give it to you. Also, really quickly, on Monday night, KHSU will air California Counts Town Hall Voter Cram Session on Monday. A number of panelists are going to be at KPCC, and we're going to air it. It's a town hall in which they're encouraging people to bring their sample ballots and their telephone books, and that will be, I believe, from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock on Monday. Your last chance to get some information if you haven't yet voted. Thank you very much, Professor Mizell.
May I very quickly add that if people want to read a little bit more about Prop 62 and 66, look up the.